the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been called the new normal, but anything is normal about this investment environment in this economic recovery. More importantly, how do these kind of returns, the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years, high PE ratios, what does that mean for somebody retiring in the future? Joining me on the show is Professor Wade Fow from American College. And Wade, you did a piece called Rethinking Retirement, Sustainable Withdrawal Rates for New Retirees in 2016. And if we take a look at this, one thing that's real clear, the financial circumstances that are facing retirees differ dramatically from pre-retirees. Everything changes when you retire. And let's begin with that because there's less flexibility to earn income. The markets obviously are going to have a dramatic impact in terms of your style of living. And especially, for example, if you were to begin your retirement with a recession and bear market.
Yeah, retirement income planning really is different from how people usually think about investing with the goal of accumulating wealth. And that's really why retirement income is a distinct field. It's people do become more vulnerable to market volatility for the reasons you're saying, the inability to return to the labor force. And this overwhelmingly important point, if someone retires at the beginning of the recession, there's something called sequence of returns risk. And it's not just what is the average market return you get during your retirement, but what specific order do those returns come? And when you start to take distributions from your investments, you become more vulnerable to the sequence of returns. If there's a decline in the market and you're trying to meet a spending goal, you have to take a bigger percentage of what's left to meet the spending goal. And then that creates a hurdle for your portfolio that it has to earn at least that much just to stay where it is at this lower level without falling even further behind. That can trigger the kind of situation where someone's wealth starts on a trajectory toward zero without significant cuts in spending in a way that even if the overall market recovers, someone's portfolio is not necessarily going to recover.
Yeah, I want to talk about this. You know, we refer to it in the train as sequence risk, but, you know, if you take, and I want to get to the 4% rule here in just a moment, but if you take the 4% rule, which has been widely used for so many years in the financial planning business, theoretically, a retired couple lives 25 years. And so if you had $100,000 and you only needed $4,000 a year to live on, you take out your 4% a year, theoretically, it would last 25 years. However, 4%, number one, let's talk about, is that realistic given the returns in the market today? And what happens if, let's say, you take that $100,000 and you begin your retirement in a bear market, as we saw in 2000, as we saw again in 2007, and you're taking 4% withdrawal rates, in other words, you're liquidating shares, and every month those shares are going down, it's almost like reverse dollar cost averaging.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's kind of the opposite of dollar cost averaging. Instead of being able to buy more shares after a market dip, you have to sell more shares after a market dip. And the 4% rule originally was meant to actually reduce expectations because it brought sequence of returns risk to the forefront. It's based on U.S. historical data. It's based on the worst case scenario that would have hit a hypothetical retiree in 1966. How much could that person sustain over their retirement? And that was moving away from the idea that historically stocks average about 6.5% or 7% after inflation. That doesn't mean 7% is a safe withdrawal rate. It doesn't mean your portfolio just replaces what you take out each year. There's volatility in that return, and that's what the 4% rule was meant to clarify. The 4% rule implies a real inflation-adjusted portfolio return over 30 years of about 1.3%, but that hypothetical retiree in 1966 over the next 30 years would have had a 4.2% real compounded return. Sequence of returns risk is they didn't get to enjoy having that higher return because they got hit by a bad sequence, a bad market environment early in that retirement. And things were great after about 1982, but it was too late. That person was already on a trajectory towards the worst case scenario. Since the 4% rule is meant to bring down expectations, it still had a lot of overly simplifying assumptions. And that's where we get into some of the issues with thinking about whether the 4% rule might still work today.
Yeah, because when William Bengen put that together in the Journal of Financial Planning back in 1994, Wade, you know, the rate of return on stocks was much higher. And if you take a look at the interest rates that were offered in fixed income and bonds, that was back in the days when you could get 7 and 8% in fairly safe investments. I don't see anywhere you could get 7 or 8% today without taking an inordinate amount of risk.
Right. And that's the issue, that the kind of argument in favor of the 4% rule is being based on 20th century U.S. market history. It includes things like the Great Depression and the stagnation in the 70s and so forth. And that puts some bad market situations in there. So that should be as bad as things get. Now, I really think that there are some differences today that are untested in the historical data. One being these historically low interest rates. If you look at the 10-year treasury, this summer it got as low as around 1.5%. Back in the historical data that's used to test the 4% rule, there was only one year, 1941, where 10-year treasury yields fell below 2%. So the 4% rule did work in that one case, but that's not really enough statistical evidence to say that the 4% rule always works. It's only one time that it worked when interest rates were so low. At that time as well, market valuations were not so out of sync. Today, when you add on as well that Shiller's CAPE ratio, the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio that Robert Shiller talks about from Yale University, a Nobel laureate, it's at historically high levels. This point's more controversial, but high stock market valuations tend to suggest lower future stock market returns. Low interest rates, not controversial, it's mathematically linked. Low interest rates suggest lower future bond returns. Well, lower stock returns, lower bond returns suggest lower sustainable spending rates from an investment portfolio. And that's where we're at today, where even though the 4% rule worked historically, it's not so clear that it's going to definitely work in the future. I calculate somewhere around 65% to 75% chance that the 4% rule could work in this sort of market environment, which is probably a lower chance than most retirees would be willing to accept when they think about picking a retirement spending strategy in light of their vulnerability to market volatility impacting their lifestyle permanently.
Yeah, because when you take a look at some of the embedded assumptions made in the 4% rule, I mean, if we take a look at today, international market data suggests there is no reason to believe that the U.S. experience can provide confidence on that based on the worst case scenario of a 4% rule. If you also look at, as you mentioned, the lowest interest rates in recorded history, stock market returns on cyclically adjusted PE ratios are at a very, very high level. And you also have to factor in that there's investment management fees. I don't care if you're an ETF, a mutual fund, or a private investment management firm, you're paying management fees, which reduce that. And then also longevity is increasing all across the board. We used to think 25 years. Now 30 years is the standard. And you guys are even looking at 40 years, what the outcomes are going to be, because there are high probabilities that out of a couple age 65, one of them makes it to age 95.
Yeah, absolutely. When the 4% rule was developed in the 1990s, first it was just assuming that investors get the indexed market returns, that there's no loss on account of fees that's not compensated by a higher return. So it's just the underlying index returns. And then he was thinking, William Bengen, that a 65-year-old couple, 30 years was a conservative horizon for them, that it's unlikely that one of those members of the couple would live past 95. But we're really at the situation today, looking at Society of Actuaries mortality data, that for people in decent health, more highly educated, higher income type individuals that'll be listening to this show, they'll tend to live longer than the average American. So it's important to look at these more specialized data sets rather than just the, for example, the Social Security mortality tables for everyone who participates in the Social Security program. And we're really getting to the point where 95 is not a conservative number. It's getting closer and closer to the life expectancy of the longest living member in a couple. And that's suggesting, you really have to start thinking about 35 years or even 40 years as a more conservative planning horizon. And this is especially true for anyone who's thinking about retiring earlier than 65. And naturally, the longer the planning horizon, the less you can spend because you have to stretch those assets out over a longer period of time. So that's a further impact and limitation on the 4% rule.
I want to talk about some of the benchmarks or standard assumptions that are made in retirement planning. And one of them, and it's propagated by the financial industry itself, it's what's my number? It's kind of like, okay, you boil it down to if you hit X amount of dollars, some kind of number, then you're okay for retirement. That doesn't necessarily hold true because, as you and I know, Wade, what $1 million can produce in the form of safe income today is way, way less than what that $1 million could produce, let's say, back in the year 2000.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of what's my number floating over my head fluctuates daily just because interest rates fluctuate. The amount you can sustainably spend relates to an ever-changing interest rate. And if you want to build that sort of safe income, the safest way to get inflation-protected income for X number of years would be to use TIPS, the Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities. And if you're trying to put that together for 30 years, so that you'd run out of money in year 31 if you make it that long, but if you're trying to put together safe income for 30 years, 3.5% will be approximately the withdrawal rate that you could sustain over 30 years. The other options then are an income annuity, which includes that subsidies from those who don't live as long to those who live longer, or an investment portfolio where you're trying to seek return on stocks above and beyond what bonds are able to return. That's the risk premium trying to account for that extra volatility of stocks. And then you essentially spend more, hoping that you'll be justified in doing so because subsequently you will get higher market returns to make that spending sustainable. And there's risk involved with that. But that's really what a 4% rule type of strategy is about. Anytime you're trying to spend more than the bond yield curve can support, you're taking that risk. And it may pay off, it may not pay off.
How does one plan in this kind of environment? And let me give you an example. After the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, a lot of individuals, because of what they experienced in a decade, two bear markets with drawdowns in the market of anywhere from 40 to 50%, they went into bond funds, but only to their dismay, finding they went into a bond fund as interest rates came down, their distributions were also reduced. So what do you do, Wade, if, let's just take a hypothetical situation. Let's say that I retire January 1st, 2008. I'm thinking things were going pretty good. The stock market was back to where it was almost in the year 2000. The economy was going. We weren't quite in a recession. You know, how could you predict what would unfold in the next 2 years? What do you do when you find yourself in that situation? Let's just say that you had $1 million and you were taking a 4% withdrawal rate, so you're taking out $40,000 a year. What do you do now if you're going through a bear market, which sometimes can last several years?
Well, hopefully in that case, you did stay the course with your asset allocation, because something that happened over and over in American history is there were these big market downturns, but the recovery happened pretty quickly afterwards. And so you were exposed to that sequence risk, but with the quick market recovery over the subsequent years, you're not necessarily in that terrible position today if you stayed the course. But more generally, there's really four ways to deal with sequence of returns risk, and we're mostly focusing on the question of spending conservatively. The less you spend, the less exposed you are to those sequence of returns. If you're not taking any distributions, there is no sequence risk. If it's just a given amount of assets fluctuating in the market, it doesn't matter what order the returns come. And that, and then the question just becomes, how low does spending have to get? And that's where I worry that it's lower than people might think. But alternatively, being flexible with spending, being able to make cuts if there is a market downturn, can help a lot. So just having a more variable type of spending strategy, not trying to always just adjust spending for inflation. Another possibility is to reduce the portfolio volatility, at least at times when it matters the most, and that can be holding some individual bonds to maturity for short-term expenses, using an income annuity, and so forth. And then the final category is having some sort of asset outside of the investment portfolio that you can also draw from in times of a market downturn. And that's where I'm really interested in the reverse mortgage as a way to do that. People from the insurance industry will talk about cash value life insurance as a way to do that. In both cases, you just have this asset that's not exposed to market downturns that you can draw from to avoid having to sell as many assets after a market decline, hoping that the portfolio will have a better chance to subsequently recover. And that's really the four main ways to manage sequence of returns risk in a nutshell.
Yeah, because it seems to me that if you could design your budget where more of your spending was, let's say, variable, so it wasn't fixed, because if you have fixed spending, there's not too much you can do about it. But if it's variable, you can cut it back. Secondly, if you have some kind of asset reserves that you could draw down on, you mentioned a reverse mortgage where you can tap into the equity in your home, maybe as some kind of a spare bank account or something that you have for an emergency you can live on rather than drawing down your assets and selling them, hoping that they will rebound. But let's talk about traditional ways to achieve that, because really what I get from your article, the most important thing is not what your number is, what is your predictable source of income? And if you're going to do that, I know, Wade, if I buy a bond, let's say I buy an individual bond, let's say it has a maturity of 10 years, and let's just say I'm getting 4%. I know with some high degree of assurance that over that 10-year period, I'm going to get my 4% income. I don't have that in a bond. I could be in stocks or a stock fund. As long as the market's going up, I can withdraw that. Let's talk about additional types of strategies, whether it's a reverse mortgage, whether it is maybe taking on a part-time job, whether it is adjusting your budget so it's more variable so you can cut spending if you need to during a downturn, or even considering different kinds of investments. For example, an immediate annuity. Annuities have gotten a bad name, but immediate annuities are very similar to what used to be called defined benefit pension plans at corporations.
Right. They're only about 4% of annuity sales. No one but academics really tend to push them strongly because depending on the financial services industry, how the different sectors are compensated, it's hard to get compensated from selling an income annuity. So no one really talks about them. But they are an excellent way to manage longevity risk. That's the risk of not knowing how long to plan for, and also market risk, reducing market volatility. I think really the best way to think about a retirement income plan is to try to make some sort of distinction between what are the essential fixed expenses in the budget and then what expenses are more discretionary, and then trying to cover the essentials through more secure type of assets, including Social Security, including any defined benefit pensions, including, if you're willing to make the purchase, I think it's a great idea with an income annuity to cover that gap. If you don't like the idea of annuity, then you have individual bonds to help fill that gap, at least for part of the retirement. And then for the discretionary part, that's where you can have, within a more aggressive investment portfolio, seeking greater upside potential because you have these discretionary expenses that if things go well, you could spend more on them and enjoy more. If the markets don't go so well for you, then at least you have your essentials covered and it's not catastrophic for your lifestyle if you can't meet all the discretionary expenses.
Why do you think the industry does not spend more time on something like an immediate annuity? Because essentially, back in the days when corporations offered defined benefit pension plans, that's essentially what they were. When a person retired, they had a pot of money. They went to an insurance company based on their age and what kind of payout they wanted. The insurance company would basically say, okay, with that pot of money, this is the income they'll get for the rest of their life. I'm surprised that it isn't given more recognition. Now, I know, Wade, you've done a number of studies and your peers have done a number of studies looking at traditional portfolios, a percentage in stocks, a percentage in bonds, and you also have done that with annuities. Can you explain what your results have found looking at these different ways to solve the income mix?
What I find as a general conclusion is rather than having a retirement portfolio consist of stocks and bonds, you want to think more of stocks and income annuities. Income annuities are like bonds. I mean, the insurance company is investing those assets in bonds, but they provide payments that are linked to what you actually need. The payments are linked to how long somebody lives. If unfortunately someone doesn't live so long into retirement, in hindsight, they may have been better off not having the income annuity, except that I think the income annuity can actually let them spend more while they're alive because they're not so worried about outliving their portfolio and underspending relative to what they could have potentially spent. But if you do live longer than average, that's where you really benefit from the income annuity because it's providing a source of returns that an investment portfolio cannot provide. It's providing income for living longer, and that's when you need income. It's when you live well beyond your life expectancy that retirements become more expensive. It becomes harder to finance that through an investment portfolio, and that's where the income annuity really shines. But like I was saying, it's not just the long-lived that can benefit from an income annuity. The short-lived can benefit too. A lot of the research shows how, I mean, this whole discussion of the 4% rule is somewhat meaningless because people don't actually spend anything from their portfolios. They can be so worried about outliving their money or so worried about some sort of shock that they are saving their entire investment portfolio for that and then just living off Social Security or any other pension income. The income annuity can then, the more worried you are about outliving your assets, the less you want to spend, and then relatively speaking, the more an income annuity can let you spend because the income annuity is going to pay you based on approximately living to your life expectancy and earning an average return on a bond portfolio. And if you're really worried about outliving your assets, you might not even be spending that much because you're worried about living a very long time and you're worried about getting very bad returns on your portfolio. It's the whole concept of the 4% rule is like planning for a worst-case scenario, whether or not that is an adequate worst-case scenario. But you're spending conservatively because you're worried about outliving your assets, and an income annuity can fix that problem no matter how long someone does end up living.
Yeah, because the conclusion from your study, you inject two real risk into retirement planning. One of them is longevity risk, because we used to think 25 years between a couple, now it's 30 years, and now we're even looking at the possibility of 40 years, or a high probability that one out of a couple could make it to 95. The second one is what you call a sequence risk, and that really is depending on, you know, when you retire. I mean, if you retired in the year 1981, you had a 20-year bull market that you could look at. We had a brief recession in 2001, but another bull market to 27. So you would have lived your 25 years in a period of upwardly expanding returns in market returns. That's not the world we live in today.
Right, yeah, somebody who retired in the early 1980s, it would have been hard to accumulate wealth because they were at the end of their careers throughout the 70s, but whatever they saved, the withdrawal rate they could have used was about 10% in hindsight. So that's because of that great market performance early in their retirement, which is kind of sequence of returns risk works both ways. It amplifies investment volatility. You could be a lot better off or you could be a lot worse off. And at least for people in the early 1980s, they were a lot better off. But that's not the situation we're in today. In the early 1980s, interest rates were extremely high. Stock market valuations were extremely low. We're now opposite for both of those criteria today.
Let's talk about maintaining this flexibility in options. And that's, you know, one of the things that I've seen in my career, Wade, is so many predictions that have gone awry. I mean, this presidential election is a good example of it, you know, predicting what the outcome is, which is why you want to design some flexibility and give yourself some options, or what I call have a plan B if, you know, all of a sudden we end up in a recession in a bear market, or let's say an unexpected illness where towards the latter part of your life, one of you ends up in a retirement home. So let's talk about flexibility in leaving options, because to me, that's the key of surviving in a world that isn't really knowable.
Right. Yeah. Having options, having redundancies built in so that, I mean, in one sense, if there's a recession, the ability to potentially return to part-time work or the ability to cut the budget, really the ability to reduce the need to take distributions from the investments can be a way to help. In terms of the types of spending shocks that can hit someone with long-term care and healthcare, that's really a matter of having a contingency fund that's much more than just an emergency fund, but it's assets that are not earmarked specifically for an overall spending goal, but assets that are more flexible that can be used for whatever need may arise in retirement.
Wade, if somebody was, I don't know, maybe they're getting in their late 50s, early 60s, they're thinking about retirement, what is some advice that you would give a would-be retiree, given the issues that we have been discussing here?
Well, to think about their budget and to think about how much they might like to spend, and then talk with a financial planner about running a retirement analysis to see. And what software gets used is important, because unfortunately a lot of the default assumptions in financial planning software are to plug in the historical numbers, which are much higher than the low interest rate environment we're in. But talking with someone who's got good financial planning software to see, is that plan sustainable? What kind of alternatives are available? What sort of asset allocation is appropriate? Is it appropriate to use an income annuity? Is it appropriate to open a reverse mortgage line of credit on the home? And to really just go through a whole list, how will long-term care be covered in the plan? And to build a comprehensive retirement income plan that has some sort of method built in to deal with a lot of these types of issues, that's going to help someone to feel more comfortable making that transition into their retirement versus not having a plan.
Wade, let's talk about some of the studies that you have done at American College. If our listeners would like to follow your work and the studies that you publish, how can they do so, please?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I do have a personal website. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And that's where I keep updated with new studies and blog posts. And I've been trying to write 2 Forbes articles a week. Usually they also end up at the blog, and that's the place to really keep up with everything I'm doing at any given moment. Thanks.
Wade, well, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Take care, my friend.
You too. Thank you.
Well, that concludes my interview with Wade Pfau. But, you know, folks, you really need to take seriously the topics that we've covered here on the show this week, because if you think back over the last 15 years, if I would have told you in the year 2000, you would have seen tech stocks like Microsoft pay 3 or 4% dividends, you would have probably thought I was crazy. If I would have told you we would have been in zero or negative interest rates, you would probably thought I was crazy too. But this is the world that we live in. These are the things that we've seen. And now more than ever, when you're thinking about retirement planning, don't go with these static, what I call cookie cutter type rules. Oh, you know, you can take X amount of dollars. Don't worry about anything. You really need to design flexibility and have multiple options in the background just in case the market environment changes, your health changes. Goodness, there's all kinds of things that can change that can alter your retirement. And considering today, with longevity, that retirement is likely to last 30 years or longer. As Wade was talking about, they're talking 40 years. And it's likely between a couple age 65, one of you could end up living to be age 95. There was a new book published about demographics and what's happening with healthcare. Understand this, that a baby being born today has a 50% chance of living to age 100. And 4. So design a good plan and don't forget to put those options and flexibilities in. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.